Hurry into Menards right now and save big money. Miracle-Gro raised bed soil helps you grow bigger, more bountiful plants. It provides the right foundation your plants need to thrive with a 100% organic formula that requires no mixing. Add Miracle-Gro raised bed soil to help your plants grow with organic nutrients you can count on. Visit our garden center or check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening now.
Save big money at
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Welcome back to On the Case, the podcast. I'm Paula Zahn, and thanks for joining us for Episode 30, Justice for Angie. Tonight, we're on the case in St. Charles, Missouri. The historic city, nestled on the banks of the Missouri River, became the backdrop for a disturbing tragedy when a young girl was abducted and killed. The Angie Houseman case would become one of the most infamous and heartbreaking investigations in the state's history. And getting justice for Angie required that her loved ones, law enforcement, and the community to come together in a relentless pursuit of the truth. Saturday, November 27, 1993. It was a bitterly cold morning in St. Charles, Missouri, just 2 days after Thanksgiving, when a deer hunter scouting in the woods made a terrifying discovery. Detective Ed Copeland.
He had found a body of a female in a wooded area off of Miller School Road.
Detective Ed Copeland was on duty that morning, and he responded to the dispatcher's radio call for help.
It took me literally about 30 seconds. I was just right there.
Detective Copeland had been on the job for 12 years, but this would be the most disturbing crime scene of his career. He tried to brace himself for what he would find.
I think I might have maybe mentally prepared myself a little bit for, you know, seeing a dead body. You do that. You just, that's how you, I guess, you cope with it.
But there was nothing that could have blunted the trauma that he was about to experience. The hunter led Copeland through the woods and into a nightmare.
When I arrived on the scene, I found a young female body in this area. She was tied to a tree. Her hands were handcuffed behind her back.
It was clear she had been the victim of an unthinkable homicide. Adding to the horror of the scene was the victim's age.
That was a child. She looked like she was just discarded out in the woods. She was laying on her back, and she was secured to a tree using a pair of Levi jeans.
Prosecuting attorney Tim Lomar.
She was naked. She was bleeding. The temperature the night before had been below freezing.
Police were convinced that the girl had been tied up and left to die in the cold.
She was alive when she was put there.
The wooded area where the victim had been found was obscured from view, but just 80 feet from the road. Still, the young girl had no chance to call for help.
She had duct tape wrapped around her head. It was covering her eyes and covering her mouth.
The St. Charles County Sheriff's Department secured the area, while detectives continued to process the crime scene. And slowly, more clues illustrating the killer's cruelty came into focus. There was evidence that the young girl had desperately tried to break free from the tree and escape.
The bottoms of her feet showed that she had been struggling to free herself, which was compelling and yet especially sad.
Police didn't find any clear footprints indicating how the young girl had been transported to the tree. But just 20 feet from the main road, investigators discovered two plastic bags that appeared to be connected to the crime. Inside the bags were items that clearly belonged to a little girl.
Clothes, a pair of tennis shoes, a pink coat.
And there was more.
There was one item which was crucial, and that was a portion of underwear that had sort of a frilly edge to it.
Not only did the clothing look like it belonged to the victim, police feared the contents helped answer another heartbreaking question.
The things that we were seeing at the scene kind of pointed to who this child most likely was.
The child appeared to be a match to a young girl who had been reported missing from the neighboring town of St. Anne. The missing girl investigation was big news in the community.
It was a daily news story. It was on every night, just the progress or the lack of progress of finding her. It was like the number one story for a week.
During the 9-day search, most of the area's law enforcement became thoroughly familiar with the case.
There were searches, ground searches going every day, air searches, canine units out looking just anywhere somebody might have called in a disturbed area of dirt or, you know, saw someone suspicious walking from a wooded area.
All of the accounts contain a haunting description of what little Angie Hausman had been wearing. During the all-out effort to find the 9-year-old, it had become ingrained in the mind of every member of law enforcement in the area, including Detective Copeland.
The clothing that was found in the bags matched the clothing that this young girl that we were looking for was wearing.
And a satchel found inside the second plastic bag added weight to the theory. It contained two grade school books.
Both of the school books had Angie's name in them. So I was pretty certain that this child that I was looking at in the woods was, in fact, Angie Hausman.
The body was transported to the coroner's office for autopsy. The medical examiner confirmed that the young girl was in fact 9-year-old Angie Hausman. The autopsy report shed even more light on just how barbaric the crime truly was.
She had portions of her underwear that were stuffed inside her mouth.
The official cause of death was sadly exactly what the investigators had suspected.
It was hypothermia, the cold.
And the motive for the crime was just as gut-wrenching. The coroner found evidence of a sexual assault. But no biological evidence was recovered. For Angie's aunt, Sandra Hill, and the rest of the family, the call they received from law enforcement only finalized the dread they had felt since the first moments she disappeared. That day is one Sandra will never forget.
I got a phone call from my sister. She said, I can't find Angie.
A search revealed that no one had seen the fourth grader since she had gotten off the school bus.
I just got this sick feeling in my gut that something was wrong.
Sandra immediately dropped everything and drove to her sister's house.
So I drove over there and we went looking around, and a police officer was coming down the street, and I waved him down and he helped us from there.
Detective John Lankford.
We're a smaller community and we had police there almost immediately, and the FBI was on board within hours.
It quickly became an all-hands-on-deck mission to find the missing 9-year-old.
The major case squad was called out. I remember being in uniform and looking into our police department. There must have been 50 or 60 detectives immediately there.
Every inch of St. Anne was searched.
You know, at that time, we had no idea where she went. So the whole St. Anne community was full of officers and police cars, and there was all kinds of people out there looking, including civilian people.
Despite that massive effort, those closest to Angie could feel the chances of her safe return slowly slipping away.
Minutes turned to hours, hours turned to days. Each day went by, we were giving up that we were ever going to find her alive.
It was a fear shared by everyone.
The longer it was going on, you saw people get a little more afraid and panicked. Not just police personnel, but the community.
And now, 9 days later, that fear had become their reality.
My sister's screaming, it's not her. It's not her. And then finding out it was.
The news was devastating. Angie meant the world to her mother. The two were extremely close.
Two peas in a pod. I can still remember Diane sitting down, helping Angie do her homework, cooking dinner, playing all sorts of games with her. They were just both so loving and caring.
Angie was a sweet young girl whose life had been stolen far too soon.
She was a carefree soul. She was friends with everybody. Anybody who came around her just came away with a sense that this child brought more joy to the room.
She was bright, cheerful. She loved to dance. I guess we was naive. We taught only good was in the world. We told her life was good.
The portrait loved ones painted of Angie made the outcome of the investigation even more difficult for law enforcement to process.
Everyone had that look on their face, the tragedy of this poor baby is not coming home, but also an urgency of let's go find out who did this.
That meant going over every detail of Angie's last known movements from scratch. The fourth grader had gotten off the bus after school.
The other children were able to say that she did, in fact, get off at her stop.
Angie got off the school bus that afternoon, and sadly, she didn't make it home.
Although most days the street was very active at that time, no witnesses could remember seeing Angie.
It was very surprising. The school bus let off at 4 p.m. It was still daylight. This was a situation where there should have been and normally would have been third-party witnesses, but it just didn't exist in this case.
Investigators also examined every piece of evidence, and forensic testing on the duct tape used to restrain the young girl provided them with their first critical clue.
There was a total of 3 different fingerprints that were found on the adhesive part of the tape. 2 of those prints had enough detail to be identified.
Although the prints weren't detailed enough to be entered into AFIS or state computer databases, police were confident they were strong enough to compare to a suspect if they identified one. But until then, the pressure on investigators to solve the terrifying crime continued to mount. At the time, St. Anne had been known as a peaceful community.
It was a small Catholic working class neighborhood, very close-knit neighborhood. Everyone knew everyone.
The area had a reputation for being a safe place to live. Driving by, you would also notice one thing.
Kids playing on the streets.
But suddenly, those same streets were eerily silent.
It stunned the community. It was clear she suffered a violent, violent death. And I think that's what really grabbed the public's attention.
Amy Bittner.
She was left on a tree about 5 miles from my house, and it rocked our community big time. We were scared to let our children go out and play.
The community was forever scarred by the tragedy.
I do believe that Angie's abduction and death was a turning point in our region. No longer did parents feel safe letting their kids stay out past dinner time. No longer did you feel safe leaving your doors unlocked.
I think just the loss of the innocence of that whole area, it was just gone, and we knew it was never coming back.
And that innocence was replaced by the fear of a vicious killer on the loose.
It was a time that really brought about a great deal of anxiety. Is this somebody who's going to strike again? What do we have to do to make sure we protect our children?
On the Case, the podcast will continue in a moment.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
The task force created to search for Angie while she had been missing now worked together to try and find her killer. With little physical evidence to go on, investigators reached out to the public, asking for tips that could provide a lead. Almost immediately, the phones began to ring. Detective Ed Copeland.
There were just countless leads that were called in.
Detective Ed Copeland from the St. Charles County Sheriff's Department and Lieutenant John Langford from St. Anne became the lead investigators.
John would get a lead through the St. Anne Police Department. I would get a lead through the Sheriff's Department. And then we'd just get together and go follow up that lead.
Among the tips investigators received on the hotline were stories about every similar crime in the area. One that seemed especially promising was an attempted kidnapping just days before Angie disappeared. The young girl had also lived only a town over from where Angie had disappeared. Detective John Langford.
It was very, very close.
Detectives wondered if the cases might be connected.
They were trying to put the two together, and it was a neighboring community for us, so they were trying to really research and investigate the possible abduction.
In that case, the child had escaped from her potential captor. And she was able to give law enforcement enough information to create a composite sketch of the man who tried to take her. The composite sketch led police to a fast arrest.
They caught the suspect.
But detectives determined the two cases were not linked almost as quickly.
He was out of state at the time when Angie was taken. He couldn't have taken Angie.
Police tirelessly worked to clear potential suspects for nearly 8 years before the next big break in the case. That's when an inmate named Corey Fox, who was already behind bars for murder, reached out to police.
Corey Fox was incarcerated, and he told investigators that he was involved with Angie's disappearance.
In a videotaped interrogation, Fox casually described his alleged role in Angie's abduction and murder. Throughout his confession, Fox claimed that the mastermind of the crime was a friend of his named Virgil. And the convicted killer described how he and the mysterious Virgil initially convinced Angie to get into his car after school. Corey Fox.
She was on at the stop sign waiting, and we drove up. She had a green textbook and some papers.
Fox said Angie was then taken to Virgil's home and held for more than 3 days. He claimed her clothing was removed to stop her repeated escape attempts.
Finally decided that to stop her from running out, to take off clothing from the waist down.
Perhaps the most incriminating detail Fox provided was a description of Angie's underwear.
You recall what her underwear looked like?
Yes, I do. I would describe them as pink in color with a white ruffled band with floral pattern on them and lettering.
What kind of lettering?
Lettering that spelled the name Barbie.
He knew the underwear that she had on, the Barbie underwear, and knew about the neighborhood where Angie was taken.
Fox said Virgil's original plan to collect a ransom for the girl was scrapped when Virgil became convinced that Angie could identify them.
So we decided that night that we're going to dispose of her. So we were going to drive around to a constant place to put her.
Fox told investigators they then tied Angie to a tree in a wooded area off of Highway 70.
At this point, she is screaming, making noise. She's going to be killed, so it's obviously going to cause some problems with her being loud. So Virgil went to tape her mouth.
Was anything done before the duct tape was applied?
Before the duct tape was applied, the underwear, Barbie underwear, were laying on the ground. Virgil picked them up, balled them up, and put them in her mouth.
Fox said he and Virgil ultimately left Angie to die in the cold. Police were stunned.
He was given enough information that they thought he possibly did it.
But when those closest to the case asked Fox for specifics about other crime scene evidence, the convicted killer's story suddenly began to fall apart, starting with the handcuffs used on Angie.
What are the handcuffs made of, to the best of your knowledge?
Plastic. I would consider what I put on her play cuffs, toy cuffs.
The handcuffs were actually metal. Fox's description of Angie's clothing was also wrong.
Do you recall how she was dressed?
She had on a pair of blue jeans, a light in color, long sleeve shirt, a coat that I can't describe.
Those discrepancies and Fox's reputation as an attention seeker led investigators to a surprising conclusion.
interview. It wasn't very long before we figured out that he was just making this up. He was just from St. Anne. Most of it was public knowledge. But there was a lot out there, probably too much. He has nothing to do with it.
Even though detectives believe he was making up his involvement, they still checked his fingerprints against the prints found on the duct tape.
We did. And it obviously didn't match.
At that point, detectives officially ruled him out as a suspect. To this day, no one really knows why he tried to claim credit for a murder he didn't commit. But they have a theory.
He was wanting to tell about a lot of crimes that he supposedly committed, and the story kept getting bigger and bigger. I think he just wanted some attention at the time.
Fox's false confession was a huge setback that wasted hundreds of man hours. But the detectives on the case remained committed to getting justice for Angie, no matter how long it took. For Detective Ed Copeland, the case became deeply personal.
I had an interest because I found her. There was questions that were asked that I found that I couldn't find the answer to by reading the reports. So I would go follow that lead up a second time and get the answer to that question that came up in the report.
Detective Copeland spent countless hours poring over the darkest of police reports, wondering if there was a connection between their case and any other child murders in the country.
I did a lot of work on the internet trying to find cases that were similar. They were child killers nationwide that had some connection to Missouri. Then you gotta try to figure out if that person was ever in St. Charles.
None of the dozens of cases police reviewed were connected. Detective Copeland ultimately turned his attention closer to home and found a potential suspect who may have been overlooked in the first moments of the investigation. His name was Roger Martin. Shockingly, police had written his name down the day Angie was discovered murdered.
Roger was parked at the end of Miller School Road the day that Angie's body was found.
Prosecuting attorney Tim Lomar.
He was right near the scene where her body was discovered when it was discovered. And this is a remote area. You don't go to this area unless you have a specific reason to be there.
Martin told police why he was parked there, but his story had a major flaw.
He said he was there as a hunter, but he didn't have a hunting weapon with him. And he gave conflicting statements. The evidence later proved otherwise.
Martin's odd story had been accepted during the chaos at the beginning of the investigation, but his rap sheet now raised new doubts.
He had several contacts with law enforcement for sex-related crimes with juveniles.
Lieutenant Copeland spoke with one of Martin's accusers, and what she said sent the investigation into overdrive.
She was telling me of an incident that had happened, and I asked about where it happened, and she referenced Miller School Road. She said, you know, where that little girl was found.
The young woman was clearly talking about Angie Hausman's murder.
And I continued to play like I didn't know what she was talking about. I turned to Detective Morris and I said, are you familiar with what she's talking about? So she got more descriptive about where he had taken her to molest her. So that raised a big red flag that he had actually committed a crime on that same road earlier in time.
It was all starting to add up.
I said, this has to be the guy.
In 2008, 14 years after Angie's murder, investigators sat down with Roger Martin. In a videotaped interview, he tried to explain why he had been at the crime scene.
I was here at the wrong place at the wrong time.
We do all make mistakes in life, okay? But there's a time to admit to mistakes.
I never seen her until she showed me the damn pictures.
Next, investigators asked Martin about where he had been 9 days earlier on the afternoon Angie disappeared. Martin claimed he had been at work, but his alibi didn't hold up.
We found records that showed he wasn't working.
You know any particular reason why you would have missed work the day that she come up missing?
No, I was at work that day.
You missed work that day?
I did miss work that day.
Police then confronted Martin about the alleged sexual assault just steps from where Angie's body was found.
You molested them on the same road she's found on. So, Roger, you put all that together and tell me that you wouldn't think anything different.
But I didn't do that to her.
As the interview intensified, Martin became visibly distraught.
I would have a picture of Angie on the interview table, and every time I would turn away, he would turn the picture over. He did not like that picture.
Put this damn picture so that I don't know how you stop that
picture. When detectives saw just how uncomfortable he seemed to be as he looked at Angie's picture, it convinced them they were on the right track.
It sure made me feel like that I was sitting at the table with the murderer of Angie Houseman. It was hard not to hit Ed underneath the table and say, I think we got it this time.
Investigators sense Martin was on the verge of a confession when they ask him to take a voice stress test.
Did you abduct Angie Houseman?
No.
Have you ever touched Angie Houseman?
No.
How do you think you did on them?
I just think I did okay.
You were not telling the truth on those two questions. And with the evidence right here, I think you're going to go to prison.
But Martin stuck to his story even after the failed exam.
We interviewed him for 9.5 hours. He never admitted to it.
I'm sitting in this place. Look at me, Paul. I'm too. No more.
Detectives had no way to stop Roger Martin from walking out of the interview room. Even though they had no evidence connecting him to Angie's murder, it was hard to rule him out.
Him being there the day she was found, and then starting to look at what his history is and what a monster he was, and that he'd done this to other girls on that same location, was pretty hard to believe that he is not involved in this.
Ultimately, testing on their lone piece of physical evidence, the three fingerprints found on duct tape at the crime scene, made it clear Martin wasn't Angie's killer.
We actually obtained his major case prints, and we compared them to the prints on the adhesive, and they weren't his.
There was some overwhelming circumstantial evidence, but I can definitively rule him out as having anything to do with Angie's death.
After Roger Martin was dismissed, the investigation was back at a disappointing square one. It was crushing news for Angie's loved ones. Angie's aunt, Sandra Hill.
I asked them, are you ever going to get this guy? And they promised me, they said, yes, we will.
More on The Case, the podcast, after this. It Even the detectives in charge began to question whether they would ever be able to find Angie's killer.
We've done everything that we can do. Some of the greatest investigators were on the case. If they couldn't solve it, how am I going to solve it?
But despite those doubts, the team never gave up. And police were not alone in their commitment. The community never forgot the young girl. A group of concerned citizens created a Facebook page called Angie's Angels for Justice. And their dedication kept the story in the public eye. Trisha Trout.
Being parents ourselves, we can't imagine not knowing who did this to your child.
Debbie Klingler.
It's been 25 years and we still don't have her monster. And that's why I decided to do the page, Justice for Angie Houseman.
The St. Charles County Prosecutor's Office heard the community's rallying cry and responded. Prosecuting Attorney Tim Lomar.
Everybody knew about Angie's case. This is a tragic piece of the fabric of who we are in this region.
The office formed a new task force to reopen the investigation.
We knew that DNA was the only way we were going to solve this case. That much was certain.
Investigators zeroed in on the crime scene evidence. They hoped the latest advances in forensic science might provide them with the lead they needed. Detective Ed Copeland.
We approached the lab and said, let's do something with this evidence. Let's go back over it.
New techniques were being developed that allowed technicians to find trace DNA if a suspect had merely been in contact with an item. Forensic scientist Brian Cry spent more than a decade searching for touch DNA evidence.
My primary focus was looking at the handcuffs, the duct tape, and the underpants because I knew that the suspect had handled those.
The fingerprints on the duct tape appeared the most promising, but surprisingly, that area yielded no DNA evidence.
The adhesive where the fingerprints were found, that had turned to dust.
An examination of the handcuffs also led nowhere.
The main challenge on the handcuffs is that they were covered in Angie's blood.
The setbacks only pushed Brian Cry and his team to dig deeper. He analyzed every piece of evidence available to him, using the newest DNA technology.
I tested over 500 samples. I never wanted to give up.
And their tenacity paid off.
I finally got a male DNA profile from the underpants.
When Brian said, I got a DNA profile, it just blew the whole case wide open.
The DNA profile was immediately run through CODIS. The results were stunning. The DNA came back to a man named Earl Cox. Detective Copeland immediately called Lieutenant Langford with the news.
I was driving home. I was in the police car. Ed called and said, you won't believe it, but we have a hit from Angie. I think he could hardly talk. I pulled over, started crying. I'll never forget this day. And he was able to get his composure again and said, meet me and let's talk about this.
The name Earl Cox had never been referenced in the case file. But one look at Earl Cox's criminal history made it clear the team was on the right track. He had left a trail of young victims wherever he had been.
Anytime in his life where he wasn't behind bars, he was hurting a little girl. He was an absolute monster.
Police found Cox in a federal prison with no release date after a conviction for child pornography. Investigators boarded a plane to question a now 61-year-old Cox in North Carolina.
I will agree to listen to everything you have to say. Uh-huh. I'm telling you right now, I'm not going to comment on anything.
So, do you have any idea, knowing where we're from, what we might want to talk to you about?
No.
He sat down with our investigative team, and it was explained to him that his DNA was confirmed to be found on Angie Hausman's underwear, which was found at the crime scene of her death.
Is there any reason your DNA would be on these pages?
I think I'll agree with him, but I'm not going to answer.
Okay, good.
As prosecutor Tim Lomhar listened to the interview, he became convinced the investigation had reached a turning point.
My instincts told me two things. Number one, we had the right guy. And number two, he's going to confess to this crime.
Investigators hoped additional physical evidence might force Cox to confess. They obtained a full set of fingerprints for comparison with the ones that had originally been lifted from the duct tape. The lab came back with promising news.
He was positively a match to those partial fingerprints found on the adhesive side of the duct tape.
The results proved to investigators that they now knew who killed Angie Hausman.
There was no doubt in my mind that Earl Cox was the perpetrator.
Earl Cox was charged with kidnapping and murder in the first degree. Angie's aunt, Sandra Hill, couldn't believe it when she heard the news on TV.
I smiled, and I'm like, I hope it is. I hope it's true. And when it was true, it's like, finally, we have him. He's not ever going to hurt anybody else again.
Although Sandra was relieved to have some answers, the news was bittersweet. Her sister Diane had died of cancer without ever knowing who had murdered her daughter.
Diane was never the same after Angie got killed. But she did have that hope that one day that we'd find answers.
Prosecutor Tim Lomhar wanted answers too and used every tool at his disposal to get a confession from Cox.
I made it clear to his counsel that if I ask for the death penalty publicly, I can't walk back the death penalty. So here's your chance. Tell me now.
And the tactic paid off.
After consultations with his counsel, we were given a version of what took place.
Prosecutors believed Cox's account was self-serving, but included enough detail to prove he was Angie's killer.
What he said is that he was parked on the side of the road because he had some car trouble. And out of the corner of his eye, he sees the school bus pass by. And the next thing he knows, there's a little girl engaging him in conversation.
And then the next thing he knew, the girl was sitting in his car. So he took the girl, left that neighborhood, and then drove to his house.
Cox provided few details about what happened over the next 9 days.
He did acknowledge that. He kept her in his home. And he also acknowledged that he did, in fact, sexually abuse Angie before ultimately taking her life.
Cox pled guilty and was spared the death penalty. He was sentenced to life in prison. Angie's aunt attended the proceedings.
I had to be there. My sister was gone. And I had to see this through for her and for Angie.
But the testimony she heard will torment her for the rest of her life.
You think that you really want to know what happened, but having to sit in that courtroom and hear what he did to her, I kind of wish I never heard it.
It was what this child went through. That's the things that is hard to deal with. That's tough.
It was also tough to hear Angie's family finally face her killer and tell him what he had stolen from them.
As I listen to these grown men and grown women break down weeping over their memories of Angie, I don't think you could be human and listen to that stuff and not be impacted yourself. I had a lump in my throat as I listened to this, and I couldn't even imagine how devastating it would be to have that little girl be my daughter, my cousin, my sister. So it really humanized the situation for me, unlike at any time before I'd been involved.
The guilty plea marked the end of a long journey, not only for Angie's family, but for the investigators who worked tirelessly on the case. They will never forget Angie, but they can now turn the page on this tragic chapter of their lives.
Closure. Closure to not just my colleagues, my family, just closure, and to Angie's family and all the people there that supported us during this investigation. Just to see him behind bars, it's the greatest feeling in the world.
I kept her picture on my wall. I just have that conversation with her every once in a while. Sorry.
Sandra Hill will always be grateful for the dedication of law enforcement. And she believes her sister and Angie are as well.
I know my sister knows, because when we walked out that courthouse that day, the sun was shining real bright. And I just want to believe that was her saying, "Great job, guys. You did it. He's where he belongs."
Police continue to investigate the possibility that Earl Cox was involved in other unsolved child sex crimes. Thanks for listening. Please don't forget to follow, rate, and review. And if you want more information on today's case, visit facebook.com/paulazanofficial or just click the link in the episode description. I'm Paula Zahn. Please join us again next Wednesday when we're back on the case, the podcast.